Sanborn here, along with Lauren Beagle, our Generation Z correspondent. Lauren, how you been doing?
I've been good. It's been a minute, Dr. Bob.
I know.
Since we've been in here.
I know. Wow. We have a great show today, though.
I hope we do. I think we do.
I think we do. Welcome to Growing Up in America here on 90.1 FM KPFT. This is a discussion on our children, public policy. How do we as a city, community do when it comes to taking care of all of our kids? Growing Up in America is a production of Children at Risk, the voice of Texas's children, a nonprofit organization dedicated to research, public policy, law, collaborative action on behalf of our youth. And every week we fill this same 60 minutes with lively discussion. And it's especially lively when Lauren Beagle joins the group here. And so today we have a couple of interesting things, right? Our number for the date of the day is 51. Any ideas? I don't even know what the topic is. Do you?
No, I don't. And we don't normally have, you know, I feel like normally 51, it might be a percent, but then that's over half. Maybe. So yeah, that would be half. A big percent. I have number no idea.
Number 51 would be, oh, you know what? I'm going to guess.
Okay.
We are 51 out of 51 when it comes to mental health access in the state of Texas. That's my guess.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
So all right.
I have no idea.
I'll lock in with you on that one.
Then we have a good thumbs up, thumbs down today. We're going to be talking a little bit about
manners.
Manners. Yeah. So I'm always up for that. So we're real excited. A number of good topics today. Last week there was that immigration town hall. Were you able to go to that, Lauren?
I was not. I was sad to miss it. It looked like a very, I follow both, obviously, the Children at Risk side, and then it was hosted at the Baker Institute, which does some really good. I mean, they get really in the weeds.
Yeah, over at Rice University.
Yeah.
Really nice thing. Yeah.
So I'm sad I didn't miss it. I'm sad I missed it, but it looked like a really cool discussion.
Yeah, I think people sort of learned a lot about immigration. This is interesting, right? And I'm sure you guys talked a little bit about this last week, but immigration seems to be one of those areas where we're not seeing a lot of movement. It's like people don't want to speak rationally about this particular mm-hmm. topic. So it's we find this all the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just there's so many narratives that, you know, we just kind of put our heads in the sand when it comes to the data sometimes, and it's so heated when really this is so many kids, and
right.
trying to put them all in one bucket of this or that without just like having an actual discussion is so challenging. So
let's go to our theme music for thumbs up, thumbs down. We have a little thumbs up, thumbs down theme music.
Dr. Bob, now this could split quite a few different ways, but I think this could be a fun
okay.
generational split.
Okay, good generational split. I'm up for it.
When someone says thank you,
yeah.
how do you respond?
You're welcome.
And there it is, folks. The answer. Because the real thumbs up, thumbs down is thumbs up, thumbs down, no problem. Let me tell you, my mom,
yes.
who is your age,
a youngster. You were
She's sprightly, and thankfully she doesn't listen to the radio because I just told everyone that. There is no easier way to just piss her off than to say no problem if she says thank you. Like, I remember we would bag at the grocery store, and she would say thank you so much, and they'd go no problem, and she would like walk out in a huff at the grocery store.
Oh, wow.
Because she felt it was like so the right thing to do.
Yeah.
To say you're welcome and not no problem. But I personally...
You say no problem?
I do sometimes. I mean, it really... If I feel like it's something I am... Like, if I'm volunteering somewhere,
yeah.
you know, I volunteer with, like, some dog rescue. So, like, we're talking to a lot of people. We're chatting with them. We're selling stuff. Like, if they say thank you, I'll often say no problem because, like, I feel it's my job
mm-hmm.
to do it. Whereas, you know, if I maybe have gone genuinely out of my way and someone says thank you, then I'll say you're welcome. But I feel like I use them pretty interchangeably.
I think it's also a geographic thing, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think I've heard the no problem a lot. Like in Australia, you hear more thank you, no problem. You hear in parts of the world, my pleasure, you know, thank you.
Or the Chick-fil-A drive-thru.
Do they say my pleasure?
Oh,
there
that's
as
like
well?
Their whole thing. Is they're trained to say it's
my
pleasure.
Pleasure.
They
yeah.
don't say you're welcome or no problem.
But I remember going on a trip to South Africa, right, recently, and every time you say you're welcome, my pleasure. And it was just, you know, so I think it's also a regional sort of thing, geographic. But do you like to say no problem? And why is this the thumbs up, thumbs down for today?
I can't tell you. The team thought it was something worth discussing.
This is worth
having. So if you, like my mom, have very strong feelings on whether we should say no problem or you're welcome, do feel free to give us a call and let us know.
You know what I want to talk about, thumbs up, thumbs down today, is I know last week you had a little bit of discussion on the four-day school week.
And are you going to propose a four-day work week? If so, children at risk, staff in the booth. Can we get a thumbs up?
But here's the thing is that I've been doing so many media interviews on this topic because people, and of course it appeared in the Houston Chronicle yesterday, I think it was the headline. It was in today as well. I'm sorry I wasn't available to listen to the show last week, but it was really interesting to me is that in one fell swoop, you had the school board in Crosby say, we're going to go to a four-day school week, which in a sense, if you look at all the data, they basically just now said, we're okay with the failure of our children, right? We're okay with academic failure. We're not going to spend as much time on task. If anything, after the post-pandemic, you would feel like school districts want to get their kids back up to speed. But here's a school district, the largest in Texas to have done this so far, saying, no, we're perfectly happy not getting your kids up to speed and blaming it on a teacher shortage, which there's one, but every school district is dealing with the teacher shortage. None of them are going to a shorter school week.
And I think it's also, you know, so difficult because what are parents supposed to do?
Especially because if you have elementary kids, right?
I guarantee the parents aren't getting a 4-day work week.
Right.
And I think even, you know, I've seen just like, you know, on social media and stuff, people seem to think that, you know, flexibility working from home is the same as being able to care for your child. You know, like, oh, well, we're in a more flexible situation. It's like, have you tried to focus for like 25 good minutes if you have a young child at home? I mean, I have young dogs at home, and that in and of
but
itself
listen,
is
we,
challenging.
We have plenty of staff members at Children at Risk that you and I are friends with. Mm-hmm. We're friends with every staff member at Children at Risk.
Of course we are. We're so charismatic.
But young moms and young dads, it drives them. They are so stressed out by having young kids and trying to work that most of them, I mean, you think of Lewis on our staff, three kids. He comes into the office every day, even though he doesn't have to, because it's just a stressful situation.
Yeah, so that's my concern. I mean, obviously, I think they are extending the school day, so in some way they are recouping, I think, some of the lost time.
They're trying to, but come on. The kids are going to be so tired at the end of the day.
Yeah.
They're basically losing a full day. We should be extending the school day anyway. I mean, we should be having more time on task anyway. And what's clear about this is not an opinion. It's when we look at the data, whenever you try to get low-income kids sort of back up to speed, sort of performing at higher academic levels, they need to have significantly more time on task, especially when they go home, there's not much learning going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's different if there's learning going on at home. But in many of these households, parents are working. There's not much learning going on. And the TV being turned on is not learning.
Yeah. No, agreed. And I mean, it's disappointing for sure that this is the quote unquote solution. So
the Beagle and Sanborn are agreeing.
Yeah, look at that.
Look at that.
Thanks, Crosby ISD.
Very good. Ready for our next segment?
I am. I'm excited.
All right. On the line with us is Rekha Lakshman. How you doing, Rekha?
I'm doing well. Good afternoon.
Very good. Rekha's with the Immunization Partnership. And Rekha, it's been a couple months since I've talked to you, but one of the things that we've talked about in the past, right, is this idea around immunization and sort of what's happening in our schools and what's happening in the state legislature that's trying to influence what's going on with our schools. Talk a little bit about this legislative session and defense and what we've had to do in terms of defense, in terms of helping our kids stay healthy.
Geez, I don't know how long the segment can be because we can fill up volumes. And, you know, we're only 30% of the way there when it comes to the Texas legislative session.
Yeah.
I think, you know, yes, to sum it up, we are, you know, again, in the thick of things and experiencing another contentious legislative session. And this has unfortunately not been new, you know, over the past few sessions, but I think it's really kind of hit a peak, you know, coming, you know, we're on the other side of the pandemic. But, you know, I think bottom line is we are now seeing the culmination of an all-out assault on policies that will harm children. And what I mean by that is, you know, we've seen legislation filed by lawmakers in both chambers, both in the House and the Senate, that would, you know, essentially roll back, weaken, or even in some cases remove, you know, childhood or school entry vaccine requirements that have been on the books for almost 5 decades now.
Yeah, this is something, you know, we're not just talking about COVID here, right? I mean, COVID vaccines are a whole different thing. We're now talking about measles and some of the polio, some of the things that all of us have taken for granted for many years and which decades have proven are healthy for our kids.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, COVID is another conversation. You know, we're looking and we're talking about those routine childhood wellness vaccines. And I mean, you know, if you look at kind of, you know, recent news, Ohio, for example, just ended their measles outbreak declaration. So in Ohio, there was a measles outbreak, 85 cases of measles.
Wow.
80 of those 85 were in unvaccinated children. So,
wow.
You know, the vast majority of those kids weren't vaccinated at all. And, you know, we're all mobile again. You know, we're all flying, we're all traveling,
yep.
You know, we're trying to find our normal routine. And, you know, it's that adage of, you know, these diseases are literally a plane ride away. You know, and then you mentioned polio. Well, lo and behold, there was a case of polio in New York late last year. And so, you know, as we let our guard down, you know, as we have lawmakers, you know, adding to the fuel of misinformation and basing their policy decisions on erroneous, not factual information that can affect, you know, millions of children and millions of Texans, we've got, you know, we've got a big heavy lift ahead of us to protect kind of existing laws and policies that protect children.
What are the chances during this session that the state legislature passes a bill which says parents get to decide if the kids get measles vaccines or not? And that means that we're going to, you know, I've seen an estimate from schools of public health that up to 30% of kids, if we did that, if we said parents get to decide, about 30% of kids would not be vaccinated. And some of that is not because parents are anti-vax. Part of it is because parents just, you know, oh, if I don't have to do it, I'm, you know, I'm really sort of busy right now. What are the chances that something like that would pass, Rekha?
If I had a crystal ball today to predict what the state legislature is going to do, my pockets would be full. I mean, I would say, you know, we're not discounting anything.
Yeah.
You know, there's a different kind of momentum. You know, I think if a lot of this also has to do with, you know, it's sort of the ramifications of the pandemic. You know, we've said, you know, for a while that, you know, COVID kind of served and continues to serve as a gateway to get to all other, you know, immunizations.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're seeing that continue to play out. My hope is, you know, with advocates in the Capitol, such as, you know, the amazing staff at Children at Risk, you know, the Immunization Partnership and all our other partners going in there, arming lawmakers with the factual evidence and information, that good sense will ultimately prevail. But, you know, my frustration is the fact that, you know, we're now, I think, up to north of 35 vaccine-related bills. The vast majority of them, you know, are vaccine-limiting or anti-vaccine. And the fact that, you know, these bills are even filed, you know, gives, you know, a little bit of, you know, false credence.
Yeah.
And a platform to people who spread misinformation. And so, you know, our goal will be to, you know, to prevent these bills from getting heard, because we know that hearings, you know, is an opportunity to spread misinformation. But, you know, I'm going to say never, you know, we prepared ourselves, you know, to fight until the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's us, you know, part of the Children at Risk team who's just going through, you know, all the bills filed and pulling these out. I mean, I hate to say creativity because that's almost like a positive word, but I mean, there's a certain level of creativity in all of the different, you know, avenues that this could take. You know, maybe it doesn't pass in the school restrictions, so they have, you know, the backup ideas. I'd love to hear, you know, I believe in my heart that like vaccines are a silent majority issue, that the majority of people and of parents are sitting at home very glad that they don't have to worry about their child getting polio at the birthday party or, you know, measles at Disney World.
Right.
What, you know, have you guys been engaging with, you know, with parents, with community members? What can people be doing, or where can they find, you know, good information on like how to tell your lawmaker that you are not part of the group that is trying to get rid of the measles vaccine requirement?
Yeah, I think that's it's a great question and a comment. And, you know, I think number one is, you know, we are the silent majority. And we've got to find a way to motivate and to activate, you know, parents and individuals, you know, who see and appreciate the value and the benefits of immunization. And it's all about taking action. And I think, you know, we're at the point where, or I should say, up until this point, it's kind of like, why do I really need to speak up on this issue? Mm-hmm. You know, it's similar to like, why do I need to go advocate for clean drinking water? Mm-hmm. Well, the folks in Flint, or now the folks in Ohio, you know, there's a reason. And, you know, as I said, it's not meant to be hyperbolic. I mean, we're seeing it play out where there's truly a full-on assault on these, you know, this kind of backbone of public health policies. The simplest way to protect your child, you know, is to just, you know, get them vaccinated. We know sending children to school is scary these days. You know, parents are really scared for a whole host of issues. And one of which should not be their child's health when you've got a very easy, cost-effective tool to do that. But, you know, I think from a lawmaker standpoint, I think the vast majority of Texas lawmakers, they get it. They know that there's mm-hmm. a benefit, you know, and there's value to immunizations, but it has really become politicized.
Yeah, I think Reka, one of the big worries, right, is that this gets to the point where it comes to a big vote, and it's going to be hard for people that, even if they understand the science, just because of the political climate we're in, or, you know, and because of this whole idea of parental rights and so forth, that they'll be sort of forced to vote for this if it ever reaches the floor. I think that becomes sort of a big worry for us. Reka Lakshaman is with the Immunization Partnership. And Reka, I would love for you to come back in a couple weeks or in a month and let us know how things are going, and let us know how we can continue to help in this very important fight for our kids, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Appreciate the opportunity. And I love the jazzy music. So I'd love to be invited back with the jazzy music and the great audience.
There you go. And we're going to put a little note for Reka, jazzy music. Very good. Thank you, Reka, very much.
Thanks so much.
We did have someone call in on our thumbs up, thumbs down to say they picked your third option. They said it's my pleasure.
Oh, very good. For the hell of it, addicted to betrayal, but you're relevant.
We are so excited. A few weeks ago, Children at Risk hosted our first virtual learning summit, which was the state of Black children. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of panels that I just thought were so good that we actually talked about having some of those guests come back and talk on the radio show.
Yeah.
And next we have one of them. Dr. Anjanette Wyatt is the president of the American Pharmacist Association Foundation and also the president and CEO of Clinical Care Pharmacy. Dr. Wyatt, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
We're good. Thanks so much.
How are both of you?
We're terrific.
We're so good.
Yes, we're good.
Good, good. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, so, yes, that was a great segment, by the way, on children at risk for Black children in Texas. I really enjoyed that.
It was great. And, I mean, I feel like the summit you were on was about, you know, finding a way to good health for, you know, Black children and families in Texas. And I would love to hear, you know, kind of what excited you about being part of that discussion, and maybe like if you could recap for people who weren't on the event, like really what those major themes were, what you guys were talking about. I think that'd be awesome.
Well, first of all, it was very exciting to me. We talked about a plethora of things, including maternal mortality, which is high in the African-American community right now. We're looking at 44% maternal mortality per 100,000 births in America, which is really a substantial amount compared to other races at 12.6 for Hispanics and 17.9 for other races. So that we spoke of, not only do the children have socioeconomic factors that impact their health and they have health disparities, but one of the things I've been pointing out lately is that the health disparities start in the womb for a lot of African American children with no prenatal care. And so it's a huge topic that we have a lot of work to do on. So we're trying to target health disparities right now, especially in African American children, access to health care, access to immunization, access to all the things that they need to live a fruitful and productive life and just have longevity in their lifespan.
Dr. Wyatt, when we talk about maternal morbidity, maternal mortality, obviously Texas has one of the highest rates of maternal mortality in the nation. And when we look at other states that are doing a better job, what is difference? What's the difference in the public policy, say, in a state that's doing a great job in this area as opposed to Texas? I mean, what are they doing differently?
Well, access to health care is one thing. Yeah. There are a lot of uninsured communities here, especially communities of color with health disparities. So yeah. That's the difference. If you look at California, the rate of uninsured mothers and children is very low because they have a system in place
right. That
takes care of the Californians. Texas does not have a system in place that will take care of Texans that can't afford health care and that can't afford the Affordable Health Care Act, because even if you get on that, you still have to be able to afford it. So we need a better plan here in Texas to take care of our most vulnerable population. So it's very important that we restructure our health care and our health care access. And that's what's affecting minority children here in Texas, not having that access.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so important. I mean, we were just talking about, you know, we've talked about the school day. We're talking about, you know, healthcare in schools. And I think we often get caught up later in life. But children at risk and in general, I mean, we talk a lot about even just birth to five. And then as you're saying, before that, like, how can we expect children to be, you know, performing the same as their peers when even, you know, from birth, they've literally been, you know, put behind. When you're experiencing all of those, like, how your brain's going to develop, how you're going to, like, develop into a person is being decided in that time. I'd love to hear, you mentioned, you know, this work you're doing to expand access. And I think you guys even talked about on the panel how part of expanding access is also expanding, like, information. And I think something that came up is this idea of not just, like, the facts, but also confidence in oneself to kind of to be your own advocate in the medical setting. I'd love to hear a little more about what that has looked like in your work.
In my work, I've been going around. I've spoken all over the, you know, United States trying to get people to understand advocacy is the key. Not only having an advocate on a you know, social level, but also having an advocate to go to the doctor with you. A lot of mothers don't understand that the medical lingo is not, you know, it's not for the layperson. It's just people that understand it. A lot of times the doctors are speaking over the head of the mother about their child or of the mother that is pregnant, you know, and having the baby. So having an advocate there for you is very important to help bounce, you know, help with the questions, help bounce things off of the doctor and thoroughly have the patient understand what they need to do for better health. With diabetes, with a lot of the disease states that negatively affect communities of color, a lot of times the language is used and there's not health literacy there. So if you're talking to a patient and they don't read or write or they don't understand the language, they're not comprehending what they need to do for better health or to improve their health. So it goes even back to health literacy, health equity, and then, you know, maybe we can understand why people aren't doing better with their health, especially children, because a parent has to understand what to do for the child.
You know, it's really interesting, Dr. White. I was in a conversation recently where someone, I was talking about sort of access to health care and what a poor state we are here in Texas in regards to health care. And someone, and you would expect this, someone says, well, listen, we have the best health care in the world in the United States. Just name a place where there's better health care. And I think a lot of people in the room were stunned because you could pretty much go to almost any other developed country and you'd find lower rates of maternal mortality. You'd have higher rates of access to health. You know, overall, you know, maybe at the top end, right? If you have some sort of rare form of cancer, you're going to get great care. But for the average person and the vast majority of Americans, healthcare is not better here than anywhere else. And we're seeing this pretty clearly in this data.
Absolutely. We're seeing it very clear. And I think on the political level, we need more advocacy from those in the position to make a difference, introducing bills that can go through the Texas legislature to change our thought process when it comes to health care in Texas, because we are behind the eight ball. We are definitely failing our Texans.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Dr. Anjanette Wyatt, who is with us at our big State of Black Children. We were excited about that. And she is the CEO of Clinical Care Pharmacy. And Dr. Wyatt, thank you so much for the work that you do. And I hope we can get you back on the program on Growing Up in America sometime soon.
Thanks, Dr. Wyatt.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT. All right. Layla Mazzali is with us. Layla is the director of the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation at Children at Risk, and she is all things data all the time. Layla, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Very good. And, you know, I'm looking here, 51, and at the top of the show, we had no idea what 51 meant, but you know what I love to talk about, 51, right? 51st out of 51 places, Texas, in terms of mental health access. Is that perchance what we're talking about today?
I would like to interrupt. Mm-hmm. If it is what you plan to talk about, can you change it so Dr. Bob isn't so smug from guessing correctly earlier in the show? You should see him grinning here, waiting for you to tell him he's right.
And for our listeners, we want to be clear that Dr. Bob actually has no idea what we're going to talk about.
Right.
And so that was just a lucky guess.
So she's just piling it on, isn't she?
Is rated 51, so ranked 51st out of 51 in youth who had a major depressive episode who did not access mental health services, adults with a disability who could not see a doctor due to cost, and adults with a mental illness who are uninsured. So not faring all that great.
It's sort of amazing, isn't it? I mean, in this day and age, when we're seemingly more enlightened about mental health, we see the trauma of school shootings. We see the trauma of the pandemic. Our kids are in bad shape. We see it each and every day. Even after a school shooting, we hear the state leaders say, well, we obviously need to pour more resources into mental health. Yet here in the state of Texas,
trying to get back to a place that was still not great before we absolutely slashed mental health funding in Texas like 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that we're starting where everyone else is starting and we're not putting money. It's that like we are starting behind and then we are not putting up the money to make up that difference to where we were. And then from there to build on that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's, you know, we talk about this with so many things, like if Texas wants to be a leader in business, wants to be a place people come to and live, you have to support.
Let's take care
children,
of our kids.
Right.
Let's take care of our kids.
Because people who want to work here probably have children, or they might want to. You know, I mean, this is also adults with mental illness who are uninsured, who, you know, people having depressive episodes with a disability who couldn't afford to see a doctor. Like, the people who would come to work here are not fully independent from the people who would be in these camps needing these services that we don't provide access to. So it's just hard to yeah. wave the Texas flag about this, that, and the other thing when we can't do something as basic as just like provide full comprehensive health care for kids.
And here's the thing, Lauren, is that I remember right after Uvalde and the governor being there in town and there were a big press conference and he said, you know, we're going to do more on mental health. Because that's always the answer to a school shooting, right?
Right.
Because that's what we talk about in Texas. And someone said, so does that mean, Governor Abbott, that you might consider Medicaid expansion? Because that would bring a lot mm-hmm. of federal money into mental health. And he specifically said, no, we're not going to do that. We'll find the money somewhere else. But we're yet to find the money. There's no money. We haven't accepted this free federal money mm-hmm. for Medicaid expansion. And so,
the real theme of this episode is where Texas is turning down free money.
What's the deal?
I mean, throughout health.
When's the last time you turned down free money, Lauren?
I don't, Dr. Bob. Yeah. I never. My personal philosophy: I will never argue with you. If you offer to pick up the check, I'm always going to say thank you. Why? Because we don't turn down free money.
Yet I still pay you, and you still argue with me.
Yeah, because that doesn't get rid of my money. And that money is far from free. Look at me.
That's true.
Here
that
I
is
am.
Right. It's not free money. So anyway, we're sorry we missed Layla on that one, but we're happy to have her call in.
Thanks, Layla, if you can hear us, wherever you ended up.
All right, let's take a journey into the classroom, Lauren Beagle.
Oh, boy.
And remember back in the day when you were in school and you were writing. And so we're going to talk a little bit about one of the great performing schools, Albright Middle School, which is a great school. And with us today, Erica Milson, who's with Children at Risk with our Texas A-plus division, where they go out there into the schools. And Maria Morales, who's a specialist at Albright Middle School. And Erica and Maria, thanks so much for being on the program today.
Thank you. How are you guys doing?
Very good, very good. And Erica, remind me of this. Where is Albright in Aldine? Is that right?
It's A-Leaf.
A-Leaf. You know, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I get the two mixed. A-Leaf, right? I mean, who can't represent for A-Leaf? I mean, what
True.
A great area that is. So, right. What is it that? And I'd love for Maria to talk a little bit about this. What is it that A-Leaf, that Albright Middle School is doing differently around writing in the schools that's making it into this overachieving school that it is?
Yes, well, thank you for having me on this afternoon.
Sure.
I really think one of the biggest things that I know kind of is a standout for my campus is that we have a variety of texts on our campus.
Mm.
We are not afraid to buy books, have all sorts of genres, types of texts, magazines. I mean, we really try to be text rich on our campus because I really think that good, strong, avid readers make good writers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in this climate, and I don't want to get super political here, Maria, but in this climate,
you can't help
where himself. People are like banning books and stuff, it's almost like people are anti-literate, but isn't it refreshing,
yes.
though, to have a campus where you have all these books and newspapers and things to read? I remember reading a piece of research, and this is a number of years ago, that any home where you have a lot of books and magazines lying around, these are homes where kids are achieving at higher academic levels because the reading is very accessible. And in a sense, that's what you're reproducing at Albright.
Yes. And, you know, especially for this middle school age, a lot of kids really start disengaging from just independent reading, kind of reading for fun, So we really do a great job of incorporating book clubs and offering as much choice as the teachers are comfortable with, you know, for every round of book club. So, you know, that way we can kind of bring that joy back to reading for our teens and just, you know, make sure we have like a variety that any kid can connect to and find, you know, a theme or a character that they really want to get, you know, to know more, to be able to at the end kind of respond to, you know, the text in writing and in conversation.
Erica, from your perspective, where you see a lot of other schools, right, you're helping schools sort of turn themselves around in these areas. It's more than that at Albright, though. I mean, it's more than just having books around, right? I mean, there are obviously some highly capable people doing some extraordinary things out there.
Yes. So one kudos that I give Maria and her team is the shift from, I know when I was in school, there was such a huge focus on writing a 5-paragraph essay. So it was more about how much you could write. And they're really focusing on the quality. So just getting kids to respond to, like Maria said, a theme or a character, whether it be short, like something brief, they're just focusing on kids being able to understand you have something to say about it, so write it down. And it mimics a lot of what they're going to see on the state assessment. And it just makes it a little bit more accessible for all students. Like, it's not so much focused on the length, like, are you writing 2 pages? But you just have some good thoughts, and we want you to get it down, and we're going to show you how to develop and craft that in a way that everyone can understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. It would be successful, especially, I think, in a world where the way that we are all communicating with each other is changing a whole lot. Like, I can't say that I've had to use the 5-paragraph essay format in a minute, but I have had to use the idea of laying out clearly what I want to say, of tying back to that consistently, of those less, you know, regimented, you know, really, yeah, to your point, that focus on, like, can people understand what you're saying? Are you communicating effectively in whatever medium? And kind of to that end, I'd love to hear a little bit from either or both of you about, you know, as students, I'm sure, are, you know, more and more online, participating and, I guess, communicating in a way in that medium. You know, how are y'all, I guess, engaging with the fact that so much of their lives is happening online? And I think, you know, looking back when I was in middle school, that's where I spent a lot of my time when I stopped reading for fun, was on my phone. So I guess, you know, you're talking about really meeting them where they're at. How does that play in with, you know, technology and social media and all of that?
Yeah, so like one big change this year is we're more of a one-to-one campus and district. So it's really kind of making that, but having the balance of there's times where it's an online assignment and there's time where it's still a paper pencil, you know, task. But really, my teachers have been doing a really good job of really helping students bridge like that daily informal writing, like, you know, text messages, emails, and kind of how to take those messages and almost like transforming them now to a more formal register as needed. Plus, when there are times where if they have a writing task, then my teachers do a good job of kind of bringing in a little bit of that kind of social media mock where it's like, okay, well, we wrote this, you know, book review. Now let's take it off the page and tweet an author, or let's go ahead and submit this book review and, you know, kind of get to the bones, shorten it up, and let's maybe submit it to Goodreads. So just having that balance of being able to know where it's kind of like school writing and then being able to take it off the page and into the real world.
Maria, one final question that I wanted to ask you before we have to go is, you know, I teach at the college level, and I notice a lot of kids that are quite bright but aren't necessarily good writers. I wonder, are you able to catch kids early, and is it in middle school where you could sort of transform them into good writers, or is it much more than that, and does it have to start earlier? Can it change later? Talk a little bit about, you know, what are the times and what's the effort that needs to go into making a young person a good writer?
Yeah, well, I know, like, for example, in my district and on my campus is we have a high population of emergent bilingual students.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have students coming in at any age, at any grade, from, you know, from different countries. And so truly, we really meet students where they are.
Yeah.
So, you know, we try to offer sentence stems or just kind of like fill in the blank, kind of like those old kind of closed passages, you know, where here's the skeleton, fill in the analysis. And honestly, we're really big on my campus, too, on having that student-to-student interaction and having students talk and collaborate, because that also grow their writing banks before they even get a writing task.
Wow. Very good. Erica Milson. Yeah. And we have Maria. Maria Morales. So I was couldn't see that name, but Maria Morales, Erica Milson, and I also want to say A-Leaf ISD, right? And A-Leaf, the part of town A-Leaf, famous for the that Netflix show Mo. I don't know if you've seen it, Lauren.
I've only heard you talk about it.
Oh, I have. Yeah,
you've seen it, Erica. Maria, have you seen the show?
No.
Oh yeah, you need to see it. I mean, what's great about Mo is that it's this whole idea of how A-Leaf is this big, huge, you know, melting pot of so many different people from all over the world, right? And so that's one of the wonderful things about it. All right, guys. Hey, thank you for the great work that you both do inside the classroom helping our kids. Erica Milson, Maria Morales, thank you guys very much for being on Growing Up in America.
I need a sign to let me know you're here. All of these lines are being crossed over.
That was a good segment.
That was good. I love talking to teachers.
Yeah.
Because they're heroes.
They're like doing the real work, right?
They are. And I mean, they're so
clever. We're just passing laws and talking on the radio. That's all we do. And yet, these are the people that are doing the real work.
Someone should put us to work. Speaking of people who are certainly doing the work, we now have Rebecca Fowler, who is the Director of Public Policy and Government Affairs for Mental Health America of Greater Houston. If y'all remember, we were just talking about the Mental Health America rankings for Texas in our data segment.
That's right.
So,
and a couple weeks ago, we had Dr. Freeney on as well from Mental Health America. Rebecca, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
Well, we, Rebecca, we're just talking to the CEO of Clinical Care Pharmacy, Dr. Wyatt, about access to care and, you know, the need, especially for Black families and more generally, you know, minority families and communities to have better access to health care. And I think sometimes, you know, mental health care and coverage gets left out of that conversation. So I'd love to hear, you know, just really what are you guys working on this session specifically or more generally at Mental Health America of Greater Houston?
Yeah, for sure. I think what I want to start off with saying is that kind of to your point that was made earlier around, you know, COVID, around Valdi, around kind of stress of kids, we are also seeing that in families and even just women, you know, who are child-free are experiencing stress and anxiety and depression at rates really unseen, even after COVID, you know, quote unquote, over and we're back to business as usual. We just see that the mental health of women in Texas specifically is incredibly strained. And so we are focusing on really where are the avenues that we can support women and where we can perhaps create, you know, more communal supports in addition to like healthcare access.
Rebecca, when you think about mental health in the state of Texas and when it comes to moms and for kids, and obviously we're far behind, but I do feel like awareness of the need for mental health funding, awareness of the need for mental health professionals. I mean, we have come a long way there. We're just seemingly falling behind in regards to funding.
Yes. I mean, funding in particular, especially with we're looking at schools, I think, is a place where we're falling behind. I think also, as you were kind of alluding to, the need for the behavioral health professionals and looking beyond, let's just say, psychiatrists and nursing, and really looking at what is the full workforce that we can really use at our kind of statewide reaction to COVID and statewide reaction to this mental health crisis. It's not just doctors. It is also social workers. It is also peer support. And how can we fund those? And how can we put groups and communities that need care the most.
Talk a little bit about, Rebecca, about this, the 12-month maternal health coverage that Medicaid has and how some of it's going to be expiring at the end of this coming month, this month.
For sure, yeah. So it's kind of two different points. So because we were in a public health emergency in response to COVID, there was something called continuous coverage for Medicaid, where people, no matter their eligibility, were able to stay on and actually have health care. But now on the 31st of this month, so 31st of March, new federal laws mean that the continuous Medicaid coverage is over. So people are going to have to figure out if they are still eligible, and the state is going to have to go through a very long process of re-enrolling people. So that's one big issue that we really want to make sure that people understand that they need to check.
And part of that has to do with Texas's not having expanded Medicaid, correct? Like that, is that what is kind of creating that population that would no longer qualify?
In part, it is. I think it's also, you know, yes, if we did have expansion, we would have a larger population that is eligible. But I think it is also people's, you know, income changes, their, you know, where they live changes. So I think it's part of a general larger population of folks would have coverage if we did extend or expand Medicaid. But it is also life's change. And so we need to look at who is available. But I think to the bigger point, I think unfortunately the kind of getting back to normal does mean reduced access to healthcare. And to me, that is the biggest point. And I think the other piece to that is the maternal health that unfortunately efforts made last session to really ensure that new moms had a year of coverage didn't even pass the House. And then once it made out the Senate, it was 6 months. And then because of language in the bill on a national level, it was just not deemed, it was not deemed that it was possible to even kind of approve by the federal government.
Right.
And so now we're back to the drawing board of 2 months of coverage for moms. So,
and Rebecca, I remember when this was like a big victory, right, during the last legislative session, that we went from 2 months to 6 months. I remember going, speaking around the state. This was one of our big victories. What are the chances now that the federal government has said, no, you can't do 6 months, it's 2 months or 12. What are the chances that our state legislature says, oh, I agree with the federal government and we're going to go to 12 months? And I put it in that perspective because many times our state legislature isn't thinking what's best for our folks. They're thinking, you know, how can I sort of put a twist in the side of the federal government? Is there a chance, though, that they may be thinking we're going to go with 12 months this time?
I mean, you know, as everyone likes to say, anyone that says that they know what's going to happen is lying when it comes to Texas legislature. But I think that promising, you know, factors that we're seeing, that Governor Abbott did mention 12 months coverage in his budget proposal. Speaker Phelan also has HB 12 as one of his priority bills. So I think we see it on two thirds of the as I call them, the big three.
Yep.
So the Senate is really going to be the factor and the question that we're not sure about. But there is growing, I think, pressure from both a financial state, you know, the state does get more money if we bring, or money from the federal government, if we bring more women into 12-month care, and there are increased or decreased covered or healthcare costs. But we also just know that women need these health coverage up to 1 year. We know that 1 in 4 maternal deaths occur 43 days after pregnancy or after delivery, up to a year. So,
wow. You know, you and I both hope that, you know, in a couple of months from now, we're talking about 12 months, right? I think that's the way we have to go. Rebecca Fowler is with Mental Health America. Rebecca, thank you so very much for the work that you and your team are doing. And thanks for being on the Growing Up in America program.
Great. Thank you.
Have a good one.
stars at night. All right, we love to go around Texas, right?
We do love to go around Texas, much like our next guest, Nakenya Wilson.
Yeah, where's Nakenya from?
Well, Nakenya works all across the state, much like Children at Risk.
Where do you live, Nakenya?
I live in Hutto, Texas.
Hutto.
Austin.
Yeah. More people know Austin. So Nakenya Wilson is the co-founder, consultant and coach of X-Real Solutions and from the Austin area. And we're going to talk a little bit about family support services. Nakenya, tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing in regards to family support services.
Sure. So I'll just preface by saying that I do lots of work in lots of spaces.
Yeah.
But specifically in regards to Restore Family Support Services, I work to support families that are struggling with communication and healthy relationships. So whether that looks like family mediation, supervised visitation, guardian ad litem services, ways to help really center children in the family system and to mitigate those families being a part of the CPS system or the court system.
So, Nakenya, tell us a little bit about if we had more of that going on in the state of Texas, what difference would it make for families in our state?
You know, I think that it would make a big difference for families. A lot of times we are not raised and taught how to communicate, how to fight fair. You know, we come from different backgrounds and families of origin, and we're not, you know, we're not prepared for healthy family dynamics. And I think if we were to shift more away from a punitive way of addressing some of, you know, our areas for growth, and were more supportive and put money behind that, that it actually would save the state money and it would allow more families to stay together.
Yeah, and Nakenya, I think from my understanding of what you do, it's not even just, you know, individually with families, but this work also translates to, you know, working with schools and kind of addressing, you know, a lot of the discipline practices of schools through this similar model. Could you talk about, you know, what that looks like when you're addressing schools and that environment?
Absolutely. So I also am a restorative justice practitioner, and I've been doing that work since 2012, where we were able to actually go across the state as a part of the Restorative Justice Institute at the University of Texas and train educators at all the service centers across the state on how to use more restorative practices that were culturally congruent to address the school-to-prison pipeline and the disproportionality that we see of Black and brown kids in particular being overcriminalized and receiving punitive discipline within the school setting. And, you know, the base of that is relationship building, finding the ways that we are more alike than we are different, but also when there's harm, having a roadmap of how to address that harm in a way that is restorative.
You know, there's so much that could be done in this state, Nakenya, as you mentioned, that if we spent the money now, we'd have so much less money to spend, right? I mean, it's making investments like what's happening at Restore and many of the other things that we've talked about today, mental health and so forth. It's really about us having the political courage to make these investments now instead of waiting to try to solve the problem once they're much bigger, right? I think that's sort of a key thing.
I absolutely think that that is the case. You know, one of the other spaces that I work in, I was listening to your previous guest, I'm actually working with some advocacy organizations for the extension in Medicaid. I'm meeting with some legislators next week. And yes, my grandmother used to say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And if I were to translate that, basically it's if we put in exactly what you said, we put in the work on the front end, then we would have better outcomes and not have to do so much work on the back end. And that is across, you know, different types of social and health areas.
Yeah, very good. All right, Nakenya, now we're reaching the apex of the show. This is where we ask you the really hard-hitting questions. These we probably have time for one or two, maybe three good questions. What did you want to be when you were growing up, Nakenya?
president of the United States.
There you go. There's still chance, right? You may be too young, though, Nikinya, right? I mean, you're not in your 80s, so I'm just...
Bob. We can't take him anywhere. What was your favorite book to be read when you were a child or to read?
Ooh, favorite book to be read. Flowers in the Attic.
Mm. Nice. Very good. And growing up, what was your favorite TV show, Nikinya?
That's a hard one. Favorite TV show. Depends on what era in time. But I guess I'll go with Punky Brewster.
Oh, Punky Brewster. You know what? When we were kids, there's no accounting for taste when we're kids, right? I think that's the key thing. And so the final question today on the Growing Up in America program, when they make the Nikinya Wilson story in Hollywood, who do you want to play you, Nikinya?
Oh, my goodness. I think that's a hard one. I'm not really a big celebrity person. Let's go with maybe Zendaya.
Yeah, wow,
she'll be old enough at that point.
she can play anybody.
Forward thinking. Very good. Nikinya Wilson, she's out in Hutto, out in Austin, and she is with X Real Solutions. Thank you very much, Nikinya, for all you do, and thanks for being on the Growing Up in America program.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Very good. And Lauren, thanks for being a part of the show. You and I will both be in Cuba next week.
We will.
But we're going to have a great group here. We'll see you guys next week. We do this each and every week
for children. Or should we do the radio in Cuba? Am I going to fit in? Jumped in the cab, here I am for the first time. Look to my right and I see the Hollywood sign. This is all so crazy. Everybody seems so famous. My tummy's turning and I'm feeling kind of homesick. Too much pressure and I'm nervous. That's when the taxi man turned on the radio and the Jay-Z song was on. And the Jay-Z song was on. And the Jay-Z song was on. So I put my hands up to play my song. The butterflies fly away. Nodding my head like yeah. Moving my hips like yeah. Got my hands up to play my song. I know I'm gonna be okay. Yeah. It's a party in the USA. Club in my taxi cab, everybody's looking at me now. Like, who's that chick that's rocking kicks? She gotta be from out of town.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and FM HD1.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Danica Patrick and proud aunt. Watching my nieces grow, play, and learn is amazing. But not every child gets to be carefree. 1 in 6 kids in the U.S. are hungry. 1 in 6. That little girl sitting alone at the playground, she can't play like the other kids. She doesn't have the energy because she's hungry. School lunch will be her only meal today. It breaks my heart that this is the reality in our country, but it's something that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste. This food is then provided to families and children in need. Being a kid should be about using your imagination, learning, and having